From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. 21 out of the first 23 American astronauts were firstborn children. Firstborns are also disproportionately represented among corporate leaders, MBAs, and surgeons. Now, that could all be coincidental, of course, but 3 years ago, Norwegian scientists found that on average, firstborn children enjoy a 3-point IQ advantage over the next child. As for later-born children, well, some studies show they're smaller in size, less likely to be vaccinated, but also less risk-averse and more rebellious. What about middle children? Don't even ask. What we know about the science of birth order and personality. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Ask any parent who has more than one child, and he or she is sure to tell you about how different their kids are from each other. And most parents will tell you that they suspect birth order makes a difference in who their kids are and how they act. But does it? What do we really know about the impact of birth order on personality? There is no limit to the tantalizing scientific tidbits that you can compile. Research from Norway, for example, has told us that firstborns have slightly higher IQs. Research for the Philippines shows younger siblings tend to be smaller. Or what do we know about who occupies those chairs in the boardroom, the corporate titans? Turns out 43% firstborn, 23% lastborn. But younger sibs may have their own unique attributes, too. For starters, they often turn out to be more rebellious, more willing to take chances in business, and it turns out in baseball. In a study of siblings who played Major League Baseball, it was the younger brothers who were more likely to go for a stolen base. That last baseball study was co-authored by Frank Soloway of the University of California. For decades, he's been a leading researcher in this field. His influential 1996 book was titled Born to Rebel: Birth Order, Family Dynamics, and Creative Lives. He's a visiting scholar at the Institute of Personality and Social Research at the University of California, Berkeley, and he joins us now. Frank Soloway, good morning.
Good morning.
You come at this from a history of someone who has written and studied Darwin. In fact, you were just telling me before the program began that you just got back from the Galapagos, so that's obviously a lasting influence on you. Explain for our listeners and me the Darwinian way in which you look at this, because just as Darwin taught us something about how species diversify, you use that concept in a fundamental way to explain what you think goes on in the family.
Well, Darwinian thinking has actually revolutionized the way we think about birth order in the family. From a Darwinian perspective, siblings share only half their genes. And so Darwinian theory predicts that they will compete. And they're competing, of course, for all the goodies that parents have, what biologists call parental investment. So from a Darwinian perspective, we really have a considerable understanding of why it is siblings go after each other and in some cases actually kill each other, although that's a fortunately rare event. So a Darwinian perspective is very useful from that point of view. And it's also useful in understanding why siblings are so different. In a Darwinian world, when organisms are competing for the same resources, it actually pays to diversify because that minimizes competition. So siblings are essentially going out of their way to be different, and that's a very Darwinian thing. We know the most famous example from animal biology is probably Darwin's finches, which evolved in the Galapagos into 14 different species, each of which has a different niche. And of course, in the family, that's what siblings are trying to do, to develop different niches.
And so walk us through then your thoughts on how that happens. The firstborn then has sort of the first available niche, right?
Yes. The firstborn actually has a kind of a cushy niche. It's like being born into the Monopoly game in which you're the first
you're
one
on
there.
Boardwalk from the get-go?
And so you go around and you buy up Boardwalk and Park Place and you build all your hotels. And then the younger sibling comes along and tries to not land on Boardwalk and Park Place. So the younger sibling is looking for some piece of real estate that will sort of inspire their parents to invest more in them. But they're at a disadvantage in terms of the niches that are open. The niche that's open to the firstborn is that of a sort of surrogate parent, help with child rearing, help your parents with rearing your younger sibling. Be the sort of studious, responsible one. You have the advantage of being the first one to go to school. You can kind of nail down that niche of being the one who does their homework. And the younger sibling comes along and is always at a disadvantage because they look, in a sense, they're not as intelligent in absolute terms. And so the older sibling's always looking more articulate and so forth. So it's very easy for the firstborn to sort of nail down the niche of the studious, responsible sibling.
Now, there are many ways you could think about why that might take place. And I want to get to the famous Norwegian IQ study in a moment. But it could be that the firstborn gets the most sort of parental attention. They help him the most with the school books or whatever. What do you think? Why would that necessarily be? Is it that they get more parental attention, more parental resources? Do they get a couple of bonus IQ points just because they're the first in line? How does that develop?
Well, there are actually two principles that are at work here. The first is that the firstborn arrives in the family and there's no other child there. So they get 100% of parental attention. And many theories about IQ are related to what's called resource dilution in the family. Essentially, as you add another sibling to the family, they are a kind of IQ goose egg. I mean, they can't talk. They can't say anything. they're actually diluting or even polluting the average intellectual environment of the family. So the firstborn arrives into a sort of cushy situation in which you have some very articulate parents teaching you esoteric vocabulary, and then all of a sudden someone comes along who's just going blah, 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 blah all day, and it's sucking up parental time and attention and inhibiting the firstborn's ability to sort of learn. And so we can actually model this. Bob Zients at Stanford developed what was known as the confluence model of IQ and actually predicted from the model that IQ would decline sequentially in the family, with one major exception. When you get very, very large families, many of your older siblings are now quasi-adults, and they can actually improve the average intellectual environment of the family because they're getting to be of the age of your parents. And under that circumstance, IQ is predicted to go up again for the youngest children. It actually does.
And there's also some theory, or perhaps studies that have shown that one of the things that happens with the oldest sibling is that they can take on a tutorial role and work with their younger sibs, which actually turns out to benefit the tutor as much as the student who's being assisted.
Yes, there have actually been studies done that shows that the tutor sometimes even benefits more than the tutee. There certainly is a benefit to organizing your knowledge in a way that you can explain it to someone else. It requires a certain level of sophistication that's greater than just knowing something, being able to teach about it.
The study that came out from Norway 3 years ago was fascinating in a lot of ways. It showed, as I understand it, that the oldest on average, and this was a study of thousands of siblings in the study, that on average the oldest had about 3 IQ points higher than the next born, which doesn't sound like a lot, although some people have said, well, 3 IQ points can add to, 15 points to your SAT score, or whatever it turns out to be. But again, couldn't that just be coincidental? How do we know that that's going on scientifically because of birth order? Couldn't there be other biological factors going on? How do we know that it's the birth order that is making that firstborn a couple of eye points sharper?
Well, one of the marvelous things about this Norwegian study, and you have to take your hat off to these people, it was about 250,000 individuals on whom they had records. And in Norway, they basically, for males who are going to go into the military, they test every single individual in the entire country. So there was sort of nobody missing. And one of the things they found is that younger siblings who were biologically later born but whose elder sibling died had the IQ of a quasi firstborn. And so they could see by controlling the study very carefully for differences in social class and family size, and then looking at these cases where people's functional birth order changed, that birth order indeed was the mechanism.
It's really fascinating. So the second born becomes the firstborn, in a sense, if the older sibling dies. And then you see that same IQ bump. They're now just they've become the firstborn.
Yes, exactly. And when I wrote my book, Born to Rebel, and looked at all sorts of world events in history, revolutions and reform movements and so forth, I made the distinction between biological birth order and functional birth order. And it really is important to understand. I mean, functional birth order is all about the niche you end up occupying in childhood.
Right.
And so we have a very easy test of whether these kinds of differences are biological due to some hormonal difference in the experience that, say, a firstborn versus a laterborn has, versus being an environmental effect that has to do with how you're raised.
How big an effect is it? I mean, there are obviously lots of things, and there are lots of exceptions to this. The criticism that's made of you and other birth order specialists is, you know, it's sort of like astrology. Yeah, it makes sense sometimes. Oh, he's such a Libra, you know. But it's coincidental. How big a factor do we really know that it is? Because it's obviously one of many factors within how someone turns out the way they happen to be.
Right. Well, there's a difference between factors that are small or moderate and factors that don't exist at all. There's no question from the research that's been done over the last half century on birth order that these differences do exist across the board as general trends, both for IQ and for personality. They're moderate. They're about at the level or sometimes smaller than the differences that separate the sexes. So there are well-known differences in personality. Women are less aggressive than men. They're more agreeable on various personality tests. It's also true of younger siblings. They tend to be a little more skilled at making peace, mainly because if they don't, they sometimes get the you-know-what beaten out of them by their elder sibling. So many of these differences are at that moderate level. Now, sometimes moderate differences can have extraordinary impact on lives. You were talking about the 15 points of difference on your SAT test. It's roughly the equivalent of those three IQ points. Well, for many colleges, there are SAT cutoff points. And so it turns out that your odds of getting into Harvard, Yale, or Princeton are about 30 or 40% higher if you're a firstborn, just because you make it over that cutoff point. So whole lives can be changed when there are sort of on-off switches or cutoff points that have to do with traits that are influenced by birth order or more broadly by your experience as a sibling in family niches.
Frank Soloway, our guest this hour. He is at the University of California, Berkeley. His 1996 book was titled Born to Rebel: Birth Order, Family Dynamics, and Creative Lives. The concern that's sometimes raised is, though, that could lead to a kind of determinism, you know, birth order determinism, and that parents in particular, kids I suppose as well, could think, well, I'm fated to play this particular role because I'm child number one, two, three, whatever. What do you tell parents when they voice that sort of concern to you?
Well, it is true that there are fairly powerful birth order stereotypes, just as there are gender stereotypes or racial stereotypes. And in fact, we might even argue that the stereotypes are stronger than the actual effects. And I think that's probably even more true in certain developing countries where tradition plays a greater role as to what the firstborn should do versus other siblings. For example, there have been studies of immigrant families from countries like Japan who are first or second generation immigrants. And this tremendous pressure on the eldest child in those families to preserve the culture of the family from which they came. And so the older siblings are much more likely to uphold the religion of their parents, to speak fluent Japanese. The younger siblings have all learned English. And those pressures are relaxed for the younger siblings.
So have there been cross-cultural studies that look at whether or not this birth order effect that you're describing are more in one country than in another?
Well, there aren't a plethora of research studies on personality from every country we would like to have. But the same differences that we see by birth order and personality in the United States are present among Ecuadorian tribal Indians, for example, and in China. So we have a fair smorgasbord of studies in other countries, particularly Europe, where these differences show up across the board. And I think the reason they're relatively universal is because family niches are relatively universal. I mean, take the issue of the conscientious, responsible firstborn. If parents send two siblings out to buy bread, who are they going to give the money to? Not the younger sibling. And if somebody has to babysit a sibling, they're not going to ask the younger sibling to babysit the older sibling. Yeah. It's always the other
way
around.
And that's true cross cultures.
Absolutely. So there are certain universals that simply have to do with how do parents treat an older, more responsible child versus a younger, less responsible child.
What difference does the amount of age make? In other words, you'd have on a continuum, you know, twins who are born minutes apart versus sibs that could be 1, 2, 3, 5 and on down. Does that make a difference in how this effect plays out?
Age spacing is absolutely crucial in terms of determining what I call functional birth order. Obviously, a firstborn who has a younger sibling, 20 years younger, is really functionally an only child. And a younger sibling, similarly, who's that much younger, is, again, like an only child. And so we normally try to control birth order studies for the age difference between siblings. The most critical differences are found when siblings are within 6 years of age. And when the gap gets larger than that, we see a dilution of these effects. And even, in a sense, a complete change in what your functional niche was all about. And that's why it's much better to think about birth order effects as being related to niches than to birth order per se. As an example, I did a study once where I asked people independently of their birth order to describe their family niche to me. And it turned out, so there are occasionally, for example, in a large family where the daughter is the second born but the first daughter, she may end up doing a lot more surrogate parenting than her elder brother because that's sometimes more gender appropriate, especially in certain cultures. And so if you ask people what the niche was all about, it turns out that's a much better predictor of personality than birth order. Birth order is just a kind of imprecise surrogate measure for what we're really looking for in terms of explaining
so behavior. So if siblings were quite largely spaced out, if you had a child every 8 years or something, in effect, would you have almost more like a series of firstborn children?
Or a series of only children, quasi-only children. Not quite, because having a younger sibling, even within 8 or 10 years, it still has some effect.
And what about the opposite, when kids are quite close together, if you have kids within a year, for example, of each other?
There definitely is a transformation and a dilution of the rivalry, because there's more equality in the relationship. And sometimes there are cases I have a brother who has two boys, and the second one was physically bigger than the first one after, you know, the first few years of childhood. And that makes a big difference. If you can beat up your older sibling, well, then you don't have to worry about being beaten up by your older sibling. And so the whole relationship of dominance is normally premised on the fact that the elder child will be bigger, physically stronger, and able to essentially strong arm the younger sibling if necessary.
So again, it's this point you're making about it's the most accurate way to think about this is the niches that are occupied by different sibs, and that sometimes that order can get mixed.
Indeed.
Depending on how things develop.
Yeah, I mean, odd things go on in life and in families. If a child has a physical disability, for example, that would make a difference.
Let's talk some about later born children. We've been focusing more on the first. I was fascinated by your baseball study and the fact that of this study of major leaguers, and it was, 700 baseball players? Is that right?
Yes. It turns out, quite to my surprise, that
a lot of brothers.
That 700 brothers all played in the major leagues, including such famous pairs as Joe DiMaggio and his two brothers, Dom and Vin.
And so what we've seen in that is that you have a situation where the younger siblings are more willing to get hit by a pitch. They're more willing to steal a base. They have this sort of riskier, more rebellious approach. And it's an interesting way of looking at what you have said has been something you've found in younger siblings generally, which is that they are more rebellious. They're more willing to take chances.
Yes. I mean, putting it in the broadest.
Hey, guys, I'm hearing you but not hearing myself.
Putting it in the broadest perspective, younger siblings are expected to take more risks because on average they get less parental investment. And when you get less investment and have a lower probability of actually making it out of childhood alive, the cost of risk-taking is reduced. After all, if you're not going to survive, the cost of risk-taking is zero. And so we expect that younger siblings will take risks in all sorts of ways, in part to impress their parents that they can do risky things and get away with it. And so it was a kind of a dream come true to do this study on Major League Baseball, because baseball statisticians have been keeping the most wonderful statistical records for over a century. And we were able actually to obtain information on the exact number of steals each player made per opportunity to steal every time they got on base.
Well, you know, it's so perfect because, as you say, baseball is a game of numbers and statistics, and there's been a lot made of so-called sabermetrics and how particular baseball teams use statistics to develop the kind of team that they want. Billy Beane of the Oakland A's is famous for that. But I can see someone looking at this and thinking, I really want a ball player who's going to be an aggressive base stealer. I guess I better focus on the younger sibling.
Well, you're probably better off at looking at their minor league record and seeing whether they stole bases.
Right.
There's some evidence that the younger brothers in our sample were actually stealing in response to having another brother on the major leagues. For example, the closer they were in age, and the higher the probability that the other brother was in the same position. So, for example, as a position player rather than a pitcher, then the younger brother stole more bases. So they weren't particularly out stealing more bases when their brother was a pitcher and they were a batter. It was when the two were competing in the same turf, so to speak.
This is a theme that you develop more broadly in your book, The Born to Rebel, Birth Order, Family Dynamics, and Creative Lives, that you looked at that younger siblings throughout history are likely to more challenge the status quo in a variety of ways. They were more willing to before the Reformation or be supportive of the French Revolution. Tell us something about that aspect of what you found.
Well, most of the differences that I found in world revolutions and reform movements in my book, Born to Rebel, come under the rubric of what psychologists call openness to experience. I see openness to experience as a dimension of personality by which younger siblings find their niche in the family. Remember, you've arrived on the Monopoly board, and the firstborn's got Boardwalk and Park Place, and you're looking for some piece of real estate that has some value. And you don't know what that is without experimentation sometimes. For example, you might be potentially a gold medal winner in figure skating. But you're not going to know that unless you put on figure skates and try a few of those triple toe loops, which means falling down and maybe breaking a leg or whatever. And so younger siblings tend to be more exploratory, more unconventional, more willing to take risks. And so we found basically, I and others have found, that in various revolutions, younger siblings are more likely to adopt those views early. And it depends entirely on how, let us put it this way, how noxious the revolution is. Younger siblings are the sort of leaders of all the revolutions that got the Pope really angry. But when the Pope couldn't understand what was going on, say Newton's theories of gravitation or Einstein's theories of relativities, these effects were greatly reduced. When they're very esoteric, that gives a benefit to firstborns who have higher IQs. And because it's a less unconventional discovery, isn't going to flaunt public opinion, then it doesn't require unconventionality or nonconformity. So there are many different types of revolutions in science and even in social thought. And what you have to do is define how radical is the revolution, where radical perhaps can be defined as how upset does the Pope get about this or some other world leader.
In one of the articles I read, it made the point that both Fidel Castro and Karl Marx were younger siblings. So on the more radical side, that's more likely to have had that sort of effect.
Yes, I did a study of a whole series of political revolutions, including, of course, the American, French Revolution, Russian Revolution. And younger siblings are much more likely to have led those events.
We'll hold it there and come back and take your questions in just a moment with Frank Soloway from the University of California, Berkeley. His book again, Born to Rebel: Birth Order, Family Dynamics, and Creative Lives. Join us with your questions at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email them to us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Frank Soloway. He is a visiting scholar at the Institute of Personality and Social Research at the University of California, Berkeley. His book, Born to Rebel: Birth Order, Family Dynamics, and Creative Lives. We've talked so far, Frank Soloway, about the differences that seem to appear both in terms of television intelligence and the degree to which someone is willing to sort of challenge things. But there's some other aspects of personality that you were saying are also affected by birth order.
Yes. Psychologists have found that there are around the world in every country and every language that you give personality tests. There are five major dimensions of personality that emerge, and we can actually classify birth order differences rather neatly on these five dimensions. The first we've sort of already covered indirectly, and that is the conscientiousness. That's the niche that firstborns are able to sort of occupy by virtue of being older, and they are tend to score higher on conscientiousness. The second we also touched on, and that's openness to experience, which younger siblings tend to be higher on in the sense of unconventional openness to experience. Firstborns are quite open to experience when it comes to, you know, reading the works of Goethe or Shakespeare and being very literate. But that's conventional openness to experience. The third dimension is agreeableness. And there, the niches really allow us to understand the difference that we see. Firstborns are more dominant, and they tend to be, therefore, less agreeable on personality tests in subtle ways. And so younger siblings are more agreeable. They've actually – firstborns tend to win more Nobel Prizes, but there's one area where younger siblings have an edge, and that Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King Jr. is a good example. And so that's the third dimension. The fourth is extroversion, which is related – to being sociable on the one hand and also a bit to risk-taking. And on both of those elements of behavior, younger siblings score somewhat higher. And the fifth dimension is neuroticism. And we don't actually expect from a Darwinian point of view for there to be much of a difference on neuroticism because neuroticism doesn't get you much. I suppose it can in some very clever, strange way if you've worked out some way to be manipulative and get more parental investment. But normally being neurotic doesn't get you much in the family. And so we don't expect younger siblings or firstborns to exploit that differentially. And in fact, we find almost no differences in personality on that dimension.
So it's the one equal opportunity possibility.
Exactly.
Let's hear what our listeners want to ask about. Let's go first to Mary in Inverness this morning. Mary, go ahead.
Hi. For taking the call. I wanted to comment that it was funny that when I was a kid growing up with a brother who's 2 years older, we had kind of the opposite roles of what you're talking about. He was the rebellious one, and I was the following the straight and narrow one. And as we grew up, he ended up getting his master's degree at NYU, getting a quote-unquote real job, while I waitressed during the year only to go and be a making intern during the fall, kind of an out in California when I'm from Maine originally. So I kind of took that rebellious role, I guess. But another thing I wanted to comment on was that my brother and I, now that we're adults, have a beautiful relationship. We get along really, really well, except for when we are around my parents. And suddenly my brother is searching for the acceptance from my parents and kind of puts me down a little bit in front of them. And it's just a funny, funny thing because we get along so great, just us or around friends, but the second that our parents come into the situation, they're suddenly suddenly trying to be that big brother role again.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks for the call and the question. That's an interesting question. Have you looked at that at all, Frank Soloway, about what happens when adult children sort of return home? Does that sort of reinforce certain niches?
Well, it's almost a sort of a famous source of informal research that we all know about. You go home for Thanksgiving and your normal relationship with your siblings all of a sudden slips back into the relationship you had when you were children. And sometimes it surprises us that we slip back into those roles so easily. But, of course, it has to do with the fact that we're around parents again and we're vying for parental approval and so forth. So, many siblings outgrow their childhood relationship when the parents aren't around. But you put the parents back in the picture and you put all the sibs back in the picture and you get a rerun of the whole childhood experience. And the caller's comment was also interesting in that there are cases where normally a firstborn will be the sort of conscientious, owner of Boardwalk and Park Place, but they don't have to be. They may for whatever reasons not occupy that niche. If they don't, it opens the niche up for the next child. And the next child, seeing that it's a valuable piece of real estate, pleasing mom and dad by helping with, say, child-rearing tasks or whatever, may, in fact, try to be the studious, responsible one. So you get niche switching sometimes. And so these aren't absolute rules. These are simply probabilities based on normal sort of life experience.
Not surprisingly, we're getting a number of emails raising that sort of question. That's not my, you know, Cecily writes in, that doesn't match my experience at all. The situation that occurred in my family was that the eldest child was the terror and not good at school and so forth and so on. And your response would be that that's possibly part of what's going on and that that opened up the opportunity then for the next child to take on that traditional firstborn?
Yes, and sometimes it's just a genetic roll of the dice that a child, a firstborn may have for some particular reason a super agreeable personality, just be a really kind, considerate person. And then number two comes along and is just wired to be a little more aggressive, more outgoing and so forth. And so you get a switch on roles. So you have to understand that every child is coming into the family with certain baggage or certain predispositions, and they may not necessarily blend smoothly with the niche that is open to them via birth order.
Cecily also raises an interesting question. She writes that intelligence is a very difficult thing to measure. Is it strictly IQ? But what about other types of intelligence, emotional intelligence, social intelligence, and so forth?
Yes, that's a very astute point. And in fact, we don't know very much about these other forms of intelligence as they relate to birth order. From a Darwinian perspective, we actually expect that younger siblings, if they're not getting three more IQ points, they're probably getting three more something else's
yeah.
that they're using in a clever way to maximize what they get out of the family niche. But psychologists haven't done a very good job in going out and measuring that. We do know that younger siblings are more sociable, and so the prediction would be that their social IQ is probably higher.
To Jason in San Jose. Jason, go ahead, please.
I wanted to comment on how much this subject has had an impact on our culture in America. When you think about the second, third, and fourth children being the ones that aren't going to inherit land in places like Europe and Asia, and so they end up being the immigrants and bringing their personality with them and kind of forming the culture that we have in America, the less averse to risk and everything else that comes along with that.
That's a really interesting question, Jason. Thanks. What do you know about that, Frank Soloway? Is that right that immigrants more often are second and third born?
Indeed. Studies have been done showing that the people who immigrate to other countries tend to be younger siblings, and they are both the risk takers, and then they're the offspring who didn't inherit the property back in Europe. Or wherever they came from.
So it has an effect. Jason's point is interesting. In a way, it has an effect on the creation of the character of a country like ours.
Indeed. Now, no one's ever attempted to quantify or study
this. Yeah, yeah.
But it would be a wonderful study to do if you could do it, basically to show that the destinies of nations have been influenced in some small way by this differential factor of immigration.
Jason, thanks. Thanks for calling and making that point. Jessica in Oakland. Go ahead. You're on.
I was just wondering how gender is connected to birth order. I was thinking about your examples of baseball and revolutionaries seem to focus on male siblings, mm-hmm. but I was wondering how gender plays into it.
Yeah, really interesting. Thanks, Jessica, for raising that.
Because family niches are fairly universal, we actually find that gender differences by birth order are relatively small. That is to say, firstborn women tend to be conscientious, just like firstborn men. Later-born women tend to be more risk-oriented, more open to experience. In my book, Born to Rebel, I actually wrote a whole chapter on women and their role in various reform movements, and including a small number of women who were involved in major scientific revolutions, and they tended to be – the leaders tended to be younger siblings. So it was hard to get the data, but indeed the women seem to be following pretty much the same pattern as the males.
I wanted to come back and ask you about that one thing, then we'll get back to more of our calls about – you said right before the break there's a difference between scientific revolutions and political revolutions. And as I recall, I read a review of your book that seemed to make the argument that they thought at least that you conflated the two. And the reviewer wanted to make the point that to rebel against the scientific norm is a very different thing than to rebel against the political norm, and we really should look at them differently. you seem to agree with that point. Has your thinking about that evolved, or did that reviewer just not get your book right?
Well, I'd say the reviewer was making a point I already made in the book. Obviously, politics and science are very different things, and religion is very different from politics as well. What was interesting to ask is, do birth order effects, are they found in all types of radical revolutions? And it turned out that the key to understanding whether you do or don't get a birth order effect in history is simply how radical that event is within the discipline, science, politics, or religion that you're looking at.
Some emails coming in. Dave writes in, I was an oops. My older brother is 12 years older than I am. My sister is 10 years older. For me, it was like having two sets of parents. What about that sort of gap structure for Dave and Davis?
Well, in fact, he's really describing the effect that we see sometimes when a younger sibling is actually being raised by four parents. And the benefits are tremendous for that younger sibling because the average intellectual environment of the family now is quite rich with those two elder siblings. And so we would expect that a child in that situation would actually have a higher IQ than a typical third born. They also have the distance in age, and so they're really not in a typical sort of last-born rivalrous situation with the siblings. It's a very different thing growing up in that kind of family circumstance.
You've touched on the point that Elise writes in about, but let's see if we can respond to her query as well. Siblings tend to find different niches in the family, but if a firstborn has a different nonconformist rebellious personality, that person may well not accept the assignment that birth order theorists gave them. That's really what you're saying as well, correct? That you can sort of opt out of what you might normally have done by way of order.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of different ways that can happen. For example, if you look at famous firstborns in history who were radicals, they tend to have one of two things going on. One is that their parents were very radical and they were conforming to radical ideology. Now, in that case, somebody like Che Guevara grew up with a very radical or liberal mother and was trying to sort of please his mother. Well, now, if number two comes along and sees that number one is the radical, the open niche is being conservative. Now, the other way in which firstborns sometimes become radicalized is by high levels of parent-offspring conflict in which they reject the usual niche and find themselves in very much the kind of rivalrous relationship with a parent that a younger sibling has with a firstborn. And in those circumstances, you get a lot of radical firstborns.
Back to our calls. Gloria joins us next in Menlo Park. Gloria, go ahead.
Yes, it's been my experience in observing families of three siblings that often the first child is the most intelligent, but the least intelligent is the middle child. And I wondered why that would be.
Gloria, thanks.
Well, middleborns get the least amount of parental investment, and that arises because there's never a time when they're completely alone in the family. There is a time when the lastborn's alone, when the first two have moved out, and there's a time when the firstborn is alone because there aren't any others in the family. And so the middleborns, in a sense, get the short end of the stick. But we do know that in studies of IQ, IQ declines linearly. They, on average, middleborns don't have the lowest IQ. But they are, to some extent, the least family identified as a result of getting less parental investment.
Meaning least family identified?
Well, here was a good example. A study was done showing, asking the question, if you just witnessed a fatal car accident and you're very upset, who would you turn to? Firstborns and lastborns say parents more often. Middle children say their best friend. They're more peer-oriented as a result of the niche they find themselves in.
Nick writes in, thank you for this fantastic topic. How do parents play into the development of siblings with respect to learning how to be a parent through trial and error of the firstborn?
Well, actually, this is a very interesting subject that hasn't been studied as much as it ought to be. That is to say, raising a child teaches parents how to do it, and the parents aren't the same people when number two comes along. Parents are often, number one, they're very protective. If you drop it, it'll break. By the time number four comes along, they realize you can drop it many times and it doesn't break. All of a sudden, the rules and the restrictions get relaxed because they're more relaxed as parents. And that is an effect, has some effect on development. We just haven't been able to measure it in any any distinct way. It's more of a subject of speculation.
Frank Soloway, again, our guest. He's at the University of California, Berkeley. His book, Born to Rebel, Birth Order, Family Dynamics, and Creative Lives. You can join us if you'd like to participate in our conversation by calling 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. An email from Maria. Did your guest say that the Swedish study, actually it's Norwegian, did your guest say that the Norwegian study was about males? Well, I beg to differ with those results. I'm 15 months younger than my beloved brother, but I was skipped a grade, was tested with a higher IQ, and graduated from Wellesley and Harvard Business School. So there.
Well, congratulations. you always have to understand that these large studies showing moderate or modest differences by things like IQ are statistical studies. So there are always exceptions. There are also people who have 6 points of IQ difference instead of three going in the predicted direction. So there's so many things that are determining personality and IQ, and many of them going on at the genetic level before we're even born.
Here's a fascinating question from Matt. Does adoption have any effect on sibling roles?
We do know that adopted children, if they're adopted young enough, tend to fall into the niche that's available in the family and therefore conform to what I would describe as functional birth order differences. So these studies have been done, not as many as we would like, in fact, to get a better handle on the topic. But
here's another adoption question. It's interesting. Chris writes in, I was the physically firstborn, placed into adoption. My brother was 5 years older. But I broke many of the molds. Even though I'm female, I had the higher IQ. Well, that actually fits your niche. I was more aggressive than my brother, more into sports. One of the interesting things about your sports analysis is that older siblings are disinclined on average from participating as much in contact sports. So that's also part of being more careful, more conscientious, and thinking, you know, football really doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, it probably doesn't have to do with conscientiousness as much as it does with risk-taking, which comes under extroversion and to some extent openness to experience. So it's a slightly different personality characteristic. But that having been said, yes, younger siblings are about 50% more likely to play rugby, go bungee jumping, jump out of airplanes with a parachute on. Fortunately, they don't jump out of airplanes without a parachute. But they're inclined to push the envelope in terms of risk-taking.
Brian in San Jose has our next question. Brian, go ahead, please.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
My question is similar to two questions behind about the middle child syndrome, which is a term that's been thrown around a lot. I am one of four born and raised in Connecticut, two older sisters, two younger. I wouldn't call myself rebellious, maybe a risk taker. I like a challenge. I fight against the status quo, maybe. My two older sisters went to a public high school, you know, the local public high school. I went to a boarding school and went to North Carolina for college and then flew out here to California. Now, my question is, can two siblings share that middle child syndrome niche? And can our attributes and different personalities kind of complement each other in filling that niche?
Yeah, there is evidence that there is a middle child syndrome of sorts, if only that everybody believes it exists, and it's in the sort of public stereotype image. But it's also true that middle children universally perceive that they get less parental investment and respond by that in certain ways, particularly by becoming, as I said, more peer-oriented. There's also some evidence that controlling everything else, that middle children are often the most unconventional in the family. And that, again, may be unconventionality as it relates to identification and loyalty with the family because they are more non-family oriented. They have more ties to peers.
Brian, thanks. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Eileen in Sonoma. Eileen, go ahead.
Hi. I have been very, very fascinated with birth order, and I was just explaining that I'm the oldest of three, and I married the oldest of three. My middle sister married the middle of three, and my youngest sister married the youngest of three. And I'm just wondering how birth order affects who you're attracted to.
Great question, Eileen. And there has been some work on this, right, Frank Soloway, about not only who you marry, but even who your friends are.
Yes, there's quite a bit of research involving large samples showing that there's a tiny propensity for firstborns to marry firstborns and middle to marry middle, lastborns to marry last. It's a very small effect. I mean, it shows up only in samples of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people usually. So, and it's unclear what the mechanism of the effect is. Is it simply assortment by personality? We don't know.
But it would make some sense in terms of what you're talking about as far as people taking on certain niches. If you play a certain role within a family, it makes sense in a way, either in terms of forming a spousal or partner relationship or just finding who you're attracted to on a friendship basis, that you might be drawn to people who are similar in their sort of niche orientation.
Well, it was actually a rather famous theory developed by a Swiss psychologist named Walter Toman, which was a complementarity thesis. He argued that a firstborn would be most comfortable with marrying a laterborn who played the complementary role in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that the data for that hypothesis were lacking, although Toman did find it in some small samples. So of the two hypotheses, the likes marry likes seems to have won out. But again, I stress, this is a very small effect. It's much smaller than the IQ differences that we see in personality or the personality differences themselves.
And we should underline again, for those who have come in and out of our conversation, that you're by no means saying that there is sort of some sort of absolute determinism about this. It's a factor in the way people develop, but there are many other factors as well.
Indeed. I mean, there is determinism going on in the world, but it's at a very complex level.
Yeah.
And so complex that, in fact, we as researchers don't understand it all.
Stephanie in La Crosse, Wisconsin is next. Stephanie, go ahead, please.
Hi. I was just wondering if you've come across any studies about what happens with birth order, personality, et cetera, when one of the siblings dies, either when it happens when they're younger or when they're adults.
Yes, well, we've touched on this already in terms of the Norwegian study, which showed that the IQ of individuals who were biologically laterborns but were raised as functional firstborns turned out to be as predicted for—
Because an older sibling had passed away.
Yes, turned out to be as predicted for an older sibling. So the death of a sibling immediately alters the niches available in the family, and that's why the family niche you occupy is always the best predictor of your personality in childhood and in adulthood.
Stephanie, thanks. Thanks for the question. And to Mike in Oakland. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm wondering whether there's any correlation between birth order and sexual orientation, and if so, how that affects the other dynamics you've been talking about.
Yes, there actually is rather abundant research now for males only showing that later-born males are more likely to be homosexual, and it has only to do with your birth order among the males in your sibship.
Hmm.
So the ninth-born male with 8 older sisters is not more likely to be homosexual, but the ninth-born male with 8 older brothers is, and he's more likely to be homosexual than his immediately elder brother, who is in turn more likely to be so than
now,
the next brother.
I mean, what would that be about? Is that have to do with more willingness to engage in a behavior that's not necessarily perceived to be the norm, or what's
well,
that?
It could have been that, and that actually was my first take on the relationship. I've actually changed my mind on that due to a considerable amount of research that's been done indicating that the effect is either hormonal or in some way biological and has to do with the intrauterine environment. A small percentage of mothers develop antibodies to the biological process that is required to masculinize a fetus. All fetuses start out female, whether they're going to be male or not. And to make a female fetus into a male, you have to – there's a certain biology involved. And as mothers build up antibodies to that process, it becomes more and more difficult to masculinize subsequent offspring. So it turns out that about 1/7 of the rate of homosexuality appears to be due to this mechanism, which means that 6/7 have to do with something else. And so it's a small player, but a significant player in sexual orientation.
Celia in Qatari has a question. Celia, you're on.
Oh, hi.
Go ahead. You're on. Yep,
hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
I was just wondering about blended families and the dynamics of the children where there is a his child, her child, and their child.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's a tough one because now, you know, when we do research as psychologists, we like to keep things very simple. And when you have blended families with loyalties to different parents and children all of a sudden having different functional niches than they had before, I wouldn't quite say all bets are off, but it becomes a very complex thing to understand. So we have to get out the chessboard, put all the players on the board and see if we can make sense out of it. Probably one's intuitive sense as to what niches were occupied is, the best predictor of how people turned out in terms of their personalities.
I'm sorry we're close to being out of time. There's so much interest clearly in this topic, and I got a stack of emails that I've only begun to work through. Let me just slip in one last one because I'm not sure we've touched on this. Shannon writes, and what about only children? Do they experience the benefits of being the firstborn?
Well, only children are like the ideal controlled experiment. That is what it's like to have no birth order effect at all. You have no siblings. And so there's an obvious prediction that we would make, and that is on most personality characteristics, only children ought to be in the middle between firstborns and laterborns. They're not being pushed into a firstborn niche, and they're not being pushed into a laterborn niche. There's one exception to that. And in fact, they are intermediate on most traits. And that is, they tend to be like firstborns in terms of being conscientious. And that's because they're surrounded by parents. There's no other siblings in the family. They want all the goodies that parents have. How do you get those goodies? By doing your homework, by being responsible, and by fulfilling parental ideals.
We are out of time, but I'm curious about what you're going to continue to look at. You just did this fascinating study on baseball. May I put in a sort of pitch for doing more on middle children, since I am one? But what else are you going to be looking for in the future?
Well, as a researcher, I'm always looking for something that hasn't been done before. So I don't actually know what the next study will be. That's part of the adventure of finding something new to do.
Frank Soloway, our guest this hour. Again, his book, Born to Rebel, Birth Order, Family Dynamics, and Creative Lives. He's a visiting scholar at the Institute of Personality and Social Research at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks for being with us this morning. Pleasure.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our editor, senior editor, is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Howard Gelman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.